Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of January. I don't know if you knew this or not. I didn't know this until I was reading Chris's book yesterday, Chris Hedges' book, that is. Did you know that corporations such as Tyson Foods placed 128 part-time chaplains, nearly all evangelicals or fundamentalists, in 78 plants around the country, along with Purdue, Walmart, and Sam's Wholesale? They are huge financial backers of the Christian right. Our guest talks about power brokers in radical Christian right who've already moved from the fringes of society to the executive branch, to the House, Senate, courts, executive branch. Followers in the movement have locked within closed systems of information and indoctrination, catering to their hates and prejudices. Chris Hedges writes, tens of millions of Americans relying exclusively on Christian broadcasters for their news, and followers have been organized into disciplined and powerful voting blocks. They attend churches that during election time are little more than headquarters for the Republican Party. During the rest of the year, they demand nearly all of their social, religious, and recreational time. Anywhere from 1.1 to 2.1 million children are now being homeschooled, nearly all evangelicals, not challenged with ideas or research that conflict with their biblical worldview. Chris Hedges has written another book. He's a wonderful writer. His book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Chris was a foreign correspondent for 2 decades, bureau chief in the Middle East and the Balkans. He's worked in other foreign posts for the New York Times, also for NPR, for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor in Latin America and the Middle East. He has reported from 50 countries. He was a member of the New York Times team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. He received the 2002 Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He is the author of some absolutely wonderful books, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, What Every Person Should Know About War, and Losing Moses on the Freeway. He is currently a visiting lecturer in the Council of Humanities and the program in American Studies at Princeton University. I think what he has to say is going to generate a few phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Hello, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I love hearing stories about your growing up because it's quite the opposite about a lack of tolerance that you write about with the Christian right. Your father was quite a guy, wasn't he?
He was a character.
He gave you lessons in tolerance all the time.
Well, even more than tolerance, he showed me that, you know, to stand up and take a moral stance always entailed risk and generated great amounts of criticism and even anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was that wonderful mix, which is, I think, rarer today, of somebody who had great personal piety. I mean, we lived next to the church in a manse. There was never any alcohol in our house. We were not allowed to work on Sunday. I never heard my father swear. But coupled with that was a real commitment to social justice or to justice. He was involved very early on in the civil rights movement, which at the time, growing up in an all-white farm town in upstate New York, was extremely controversial. I mean, in the early 1960s, Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we forget that.
We forget that. And certainly I felt the sting of that criticism as a young boy. He then went on and worked in the anti-war movement, and he died in 1995, the last sort of 10 or 15 years of his life in the gay rights movement. My uncle, his youngest brother, was gay, and mm-hmm. he had a real sensitivity to the pain of being a gay man in
And
America.
He enlisted you to start a movement, right?
Well, the story I tell in the book, and, you know, when I was at Colgate University as an undergraduate, by that time he had a church in Syracuse, New York. He found out there was no gay and lesbian organization and that all the gays and lesbians on campus were in the closet. And so he brought the gay speakers to Colgate. And I would have to, you know, a deeply committed heterosexual, sit around with my dad and Bob and Harry Freeman Dash Jones. And of course, the students, you know, after several of these sessions confided in my father that they couldn't start, that they were too intimidated or they didn't want to come out of the closet to start a an open gay and lesbian organization, and this was a problem that my dad solved by taking me to lunch and telling me that although I wasn't gay, I had to found it, so I founded it, and would go in the dining hall, and the guy would take my card to check it off for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and hand it back to me and go, faggot.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Quite the opposite of the group that you write about, the Christian Right. Tell me about the extent I just outlined a little bit at the beginning of this show. I had no idea that places like Tyson Foods are putting chaplains in their plants.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just would back up a little bit by, you know, coming out of the church and graduating from seminary myself, although I wasn't ordained. I did all the academic work to be a Presbyterian minister. I'm just not willing to give the radical fringe of the Christian Right any religious legitimacy at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at them as a mass movement. I think that their obsession is about power and the destruction of the democratic society or the open society. And they have a very unholy alliance with very powerful corporate interests who are very happy to fund them because they are creating, you know, an America where there are no impediments on what the American oligarchy can amass in terms of wealth and privilege and power, and it is coupled with a ferocious assault on the working class. And now, of course, we're seeing the middle class. You know, we have in the last few decades, and this is, you know, the Clinton administration bears much blame for this. This is hardly just a Republican issue. Have been completely disenfranchised, and of course, you know, many of my own relatives come from the working class, from mill towns in Maine, where they look like, you know, these small towns look like boarded up war zones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you disenfranchise that number of people, you create terrible political and social distortions, which we know throughout history results in radical movements. And I think that is really sort of the genesis of this movement. And this isn't a particularly new observation. I mean, Plutarch wrote about this, you know, that the imbalance between rich and poor is, in his words, the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. And I think that's what we're dealing with. I think that this is a movement born of deep despair, a deep sense of betrayal, and ultimately, you know, tremendous feelings of rage.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are being manipulated by demagogues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly how I look at people like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or Benny Hinn or, you know, the list goes on and on.
Right. But why is it that they take on this philosophy? Because among those downtrodden are people who maybe aren't Christian, or among the downtrodden are people who may be gay or who may be women, for heaven's sake. Why is it that this is such a narrow movement and that it believes that only true Christians will rise to heaven and be saved if you're a part of their movement? You know, prosperity is yours, et cetera. But there's this real, and you also write about this military aspect to all of this. It's terribly exclusionary.
Yeah.
Why do people sign on to that kind of exclusion?
Because they're transferred in that belief system from a reality-based world to a non-reality-based world. And by that I mean that once they embrace this ideology, they embrace a belief in magic, a belief that Jesus or God intercedes on a daily basis in their lives, that angels exist, that miracles happen, that God has a divine plan for them, that God will not only protect them but make them successful in worldly terms that are a complete anathema, of course, to the Gospels. And that is a very powerful enticement to people that are, you know, very broken and really live in deep despair, personal or economic. And that's the attraction of the movement. And once they enter that non-reality-based belief system, once they believe, you know, despite all scientific evidence that the Earth was created and everything on the Earth, was including dinosaurs, were created 6,000 years ago in the span of 6 days, because it says so in Genesis, it's very hard to penetrate because you're not dealing anymore with the rational world.
Mm-hmm.
It is a world, and Hannah Arendt warns about this in The Origins of Totalitarianism, and she calls this a prerequisite for totalitarian movements. It is a world where facts become interchangeable with opinions, where, you know, facts that are not convenient or do not fit with the ideology are simply discarded, ignored, or discredited. And once you enter that kind of a world, you begin that deep erosion of the open society or a democracy which depends on dispassionate, honest, intellectual, scientific inquiry.
Right.
It's an extremely dangerous phenomena, but one that's deeply comforting. And I think part of the, for many of the believers, and I think part of the rage that is expressed against critics of this movement, it comes out of a fear of being pushed back into that despair, which they have fled, and which they are terrified of engulfing their lives once again.
And I'm amazed, Chris, from doing a talk show for a number of years, there's certain kinds of issues that you find yourself talking about and you say, wait a second, why are we even talking about evolution versus intelligent design? Some of these ideas have found their way into sort of a mainstream debate in this country, haven't they, that you think really have no place of being there because one's right and one's wrong.
Well, that's exactly the point. And once you establish a situation where creationism, which is a pseudoscience, I mean, it's not a science, of course, becomes an alternative, what you've really done is begin to discredit real science.
Mm-hmm.
And all totalitarian movements do that. You saw it, for instance, in Nazi Germany with eugenics, this faux science that somehow you could measure people's skulls, and they had eugenic institutes to determine people who are racially inferior, and of course that meant morally and intellectually inferior. You saw it in communist dictatorships where there was a huge war against physicists, for instance, because they weren't practicing Stalinist physics, and that's what's happening. That's the role that creationism plays. It is when they talk about providing an alternative or having an open debate, what they're really talking about is that very stealthy and very dangerous move to discredit science itself.
Mm-hmm. What about the youth movement? You've spent some time with some of these people. I read it. Your descriptions of these big rock concerts where they've got Hummers and it's got this huge military component to all of it. It's very, very disturbing, and it's attracting a lot of young people, isn't it?
Well, it is the allure of violence, especially apocalyptic violence, the final aesthetic of this movement. And again, I think as in most totalitarian movements, certainly most classical fascist movements, is violence itself, cataclysmic violence that will be used to purge the world. The theology that they embrace is fundamentally a theology of despair, because nothing in this world is worth saving, protecting, or nurturing. It all must be destroyed. And that's what they look forward to. They look forward to the day in this kind of strange spiritual Darwinism, where they will be lifted up into heaven and the rest of us will suffer excruciating torments and eventually be extinguished by a warrior Christ. And what totalitarian movements do, and what the religious right, which I consider a totalitarian movement, does quite well, is redirect this rage and give people a moral sanction to carry out violence and express that yearning for violence towards legitimate targets. You see it on the fringe movement with, of course, abortion providers. You see it by this embracing of the war in Iraq, the belief that this is a crusade, that Islam is a satanic religion. And you see it in terms of the way they speak about non-believers or people they classify as non-believers, whether they're, they call them secular humanists or liberals or nominal Christians or whatever the term they use, or gays and lesbians or whatever target they're going after. These people are worthy only of conversion or extinction. They have no legitimacy in the Christian state that they would like to create. And when you teach people to speak like this and think like this, and I certainly have learned this by covering conflicts such as in the Balkans, that is the first, or that's the prelude to getting people to act like this.
Mm-hmm. You read about this. Tell me about this guy who was dismissed from his post as a professor of Romance languages at the University of Dresden because of his Jewish ancestry, Viktor Klemperer, and how language was used here, the frequency of words, And it is true that words, they've been able to capture words.
Yes, and that, of course, is essentially at the beginning the main aim of totalitarian movements. They capture words.
Mm-hmm.
And one becomes extremely attuned to that. You know, for instance, when they're working as a foreign correspondent in places like the Middle East or places like the Balkans, where radical movements take power. I mean, you know, it took Milosevic 4 years of hate propaganda and verbal filth before he got one Serb to cross the border into Bosnia and begin killing. And Klemperer, I think, is a really interesting read. He was, as you said, dismissed as a professor of Romance languages at the University of Dresden in 35 because of his Jewish ancestry. And he wrote the first sort of literary critique of national socialism. And he saw things in the use of language that I think are extremely important for those of us who want to dissect the Christian right itself. He noted that the Nazis changed the values and frequency of words, and that they made them into common property, he wrote, words that had previously been used by individuals or tiny troops. They confiscated words for the party,
mm-hmm.
saturated words and phrases and sentence forms with their poison. They made language serve their terrible system. They conquered words and made them into their strongest advertising tools, at once the most public and the most secret. And I think that we see that very much in the corruption of religious language, but also of the language by which we speak about our own country, or which believers are taught to speak about their own country. I mean, just a very simple and obvious example is that they are pushing forward this complete revision of American history that somehow the founding fathers set out to create a Christian nation.
Right.
The founding fathers were terrified of a Christian nation because they did not want to go back to the mm-hmm. the kind of repressive religious governments that took power in much of the colonies, and then of course they all were very aware of the religious wars coming from Europe, and with European ancestry, many of them haven't been born in Europe itself. So it is a complete inversion, and I think that that touches on what Klemperer says, that by pounding home through constant repetition and by keeping people isolated, and you have to remember, tens of millions of people in this country get their news, their entertainment, their health and beauty tips, their spiritual guidance from hermetically sealed
right.
sources, from
yes.
religious and Christian radio.
Yes.
And there is nothing to challenge mm-hmm. This steady ideological drumbeat, I mean, which really is a form of indoctrination. And then when you're pulling children out of the public schools, when you have people like James Dobson, the head of Focus on the Family, urging his followers to remove their children from the contaminants of public school, what you really are doing is creating a huge swath of this population that is being re-educated with an agenda that I think is deeply frightening and has as its goal the destruction of pluralism, democracy, and openness that, despite all our faults, has been, the sort of heart and center of the country's greatness.
Chris Hedges, our guest. His latest book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. We'll take phone calls. One line is open. So if you would like to join the conversation, take that. I think our lines will be fairly busy here. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, the president, as you know, is giving his speech tonight on a new strategy for the war. We will be picking up NPR's coverage of this at 8 o'clock tonight, so you can listen right here. Let's go to phone calls for Chris Hedges, his latest book, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. And we go to Scott for our first call. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. A couple of quick comments. One, it's interesting how your guest just commented about how people can use words and overtake of the language, the Christian right, and he seems to be using the same type of process with words like fascist and totalitarianism. he doesn't give any credence to the radical Christian right, or any legitimacy. Those were his words. And I don't give any legitimacy to it either. But I also don't give any legitimacy to the radical secular left. It is a kind of a tit-for-tat kind of thing. We need to focus a little bit more in the middle, I guess. And I'm wondering what his views are.
And what do you mean, Scott, by the radical secular left? What does that mean to you?
I guess it would be the antithesis of the radical Christian right in your eyes or in other people's eyes. A country that's based completely on moral relativism, that anything and everything is all right. I mean, there are no absolutes, there are no truths. If it isn't hurting anybody and it's good, it feels good, do it kind of thing. So that there is a radical Christian right, which I disagree with wholeheartedly. There's also a radical secular left.
Okay. All right, Chris?
Well, you know, he raises some good points. I think it's cultural relativism, as he points out, that sort of doomed us, that everything is acceptable, that, you know, we are in a situation where we are being taught or we allow ourselves to tolerate the intolerant. I have no problem with these Christian radicals, with their right to be, with their right to express their opinion, to live and worship as they choose. But I will not accept a movement that denies my right to be, that denounces my struggle before God as worthless. I think all the hallmark of an open society is that all have legitimacy, that nobody has a complete, a lock on the truth. Nobody has a monopoly on the truth. And, you know, once you deal with a movement that announces that those outside the movement do not have a right to express their views, and in many cases often physically exist at all, that's no longer a difference of opinion.
Right.
That becomes a fight for survival.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the caller talks about the middle. That's precisely what it is they're assaulting. It is that middle ground. Fundamentalist or totalitarian movements, and I certainly saw this in the Middle East, seek to destroy the middle within their own societies. In a bid to essentially control and take power. That's what, for instance, groups like Hamas did within the Palestinian territories. Finally, he mentions the secular radical left. I don't think there is any left in this country. Certainly there is no organized left. It's not a new idea, but, I mean, you know, totalitarian movements mirror each other in the way that communist movements mirrored fascist movements, or the way Serbian nationalist movements in the Balkans, whether the Croatian or Serbian, mirrored each other. I mean, religious fundamentalist movements mirror each other, and Karen Armstrong has done some very good work on this. But we don't have organized progressive forces to blunt this movement. And I think that, you know, if there's a historical sort of analogy that we can draw from where we are now, it is similar in many ways to the 1930s. We're not in a period of depression. We don't have that kind of instability, although we very well could the way we're going. But we don't have labor unions. We don't have an unfettered independent press the way we did in the 1930s. I mean, most television and radio and newspapers are controlled by large corporations. I think the figure is 80% by six corporations or something like this. And so I worry that, you know, if none of these movements can take power unless the society enters a period of crisis,
mm-hmm.
whether that comes through a series of environmental disasters, whether it comes through a catastrophic terrorist attack, whether it comes through an economic meltdown or all three, I don't know. And certainly as long as we have a period of relative stability, which we do now, these people can be held at bay.
Mm-hmm.
But once we entered a period of crisis, then I wonder where those forces, organized forces to oppose them, are going to come from.
Yeah. You talk in the book about the awful paradox of tolerance. There arise moments when those who would destroy the tolerance that makes an open society possible should no longer be tolerated. Passivity in the face of the rise of the Christian right threatens the democratic state. So what do you recommend? How should it be countered?
Well, the message that they're spewing out, which is really one of message, really is a message of hatred and bigotry and intolerance, is on public airwaves. And you know, in the 1930s, Roosevelt tried to stop religious broadcasters from taking public airwaves because he did not want those airwaves to be used as a form of religious indoctrination. And I think that, I mean, one of the reasons, for instance, that the Christian right has worked so hard to fight hate crimes legislation is because they know, in many cases, certainly in the way they talk about gays and lesbians, that could be used against them.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, when you have a situation where tens of millions of citizens are being indoctrinated on public airwaves that are, after all, in the public domain and public property, these Christian, so-called Christian radio and television broadcasting outlets have to be held accountable. They have to, there has to be a push to include other viewpoints. There has to be an effort by those of us who care about tolerance to prohibit them from preaching intolerance. They're certainly free to preach their version of Christianity that, frankly, coming out of the church, I often find a form of heresy. But they're not. They should not be free to call for the eradication of, you know, huge sections of the globe. This is all caught up in the end time. You know, the end time. A series by Tim LaHaye and this sort of obsession with Armageddon, this kind of stuff. And you know, while we may ignore this rhetoric, it's very frightening to people outside our gates who come from different faiths, and I'm thinking particularly of Muslims. You know, Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or somebody may utter these horribly intolerant comments about Muslims that, you know, don't seem to penetrate deep within American society, but certainly within Muslim society, they don't make that distinction between who speaks for America and who doesn't. And this, of course, plays right into the hands of the Islamic radicals who mean harm to their own societies and certainly harm to us.
So, Chris, are you saying that those intolerant religious broadcasters should be denied licenses?
I think that if they preach bigotry and hatred, if they, I think that they should not be allowed to broadcast. And I mean, we're not going to give the Ku Klux Klan a cable station, or we shouldn't.
Right.
And in many ways, you know, if you're a gay man in this country and you don't live in one of these urban pockets like San Francisco or New York, life is tough.
Yeah.
You know, the numbers of suicides of gay men who are teenagers struggling with their sexual identity, you know, is four or five times higher. That I forget the exact figure for the rest of the country. You know, it's become very repressive and very dangerous. And you know, certainly to be openly gay in many parts of the United States. And I think that one of the things that, you know, I had this great professor at Harvard Divinity School, James Luther Adams, who told us that when we were his age, he was then close to 80, that we would all be fighting the Christian fascists.
Yeah.
And one of the things he warned us or told us to watch, and I should mention that he was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 working with the so-called confessing church or underground church led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Müller and until he eventually was picked up by the Gestapo and told to leave the country. And this was the sort of most formidable experience of his life. And he came back deeply shocked by the inability of sort of the German liberal elite to stand up and, of course, the German churches. And he said, you know, watch closely what these movements do to gays and lesbians, because the first decree that Hitler passed when he took power on January 30th of 1933 was to ban all gay and lesbian meeting organizations. And this was, of course, roundly cheered, not only by the German public, but the German churches. And one of the first book burnings in May of that year were the books from the Berlin Sexual Institute. And there's one really fascinating book by a historian, Claudia Kunz, called The Nazi Conscience. And she writes about how that sort of raw anti-Semitism in the early stages of Nazi rule to consolidate power was unpalatable to most Germans. And so what did they do? They promoted family values. But, of course, once you legitimate attacks against people defined as social deviants, in this case gays and lesbians, you legitimate ways of acting that are an anathema to an open society. And when you finish with those social deviants, Adams told us, they're going to go down the list until they get to you. And that's why, you know, I find what's happening to gays and lesbians in this country and the relentless campaign against them by the Christian right to be deeply disturbing, because ultimately it's not about gays and lesbians. It's ultimately about us.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. Let's go next to Al from Milwaukee. Hi, Al.
Hi, Chris. I first gained a lot of respect from you for you in an article a friend showed me. I think it might have been the New Yorker. It was the you were in Palestine and the Israelis drove their tanks up and they were taunting the children, and then the children would come out and they'd shoot them.
That was Harper's Magazine.
Oh, that was Harper's. Okay. What I want to say about this is that since John Boswell died, I miss a deep critique of the sources that the Christian right uses. What I'm referring to is that it's not just that they misinterpret the Bible, but they falsify it. I'll give you an example. There is a passage in Romans that speaks about same-sex relations, same-sex desires. And in the typical translation, the New International Version, which is widely used, that is given as sinful desires. But if you go back to the Greek, the word sinful is not there. It simply says desires. In fact, the Greek word for desires that St. Paul uses there is the same Greek word that Jesus uses at the Last Supper when he tells his disciples how he desired to be with them.
Okay, Chris.
Well, there's certainly, your caller is very right, that there has been, you know, a huge distortion of the Bible to fit the ideology. I mean, the rapture is not in the Bible. The call to build a second temple is not in the Bible. I mean, the list goes on and on. I think most followers in the movement remain on some sort of fundamental level biblically illiterate. You know, I remember right after Justice Sunday, I was on a program with Tony Perkins, who organized it.
And, oh, my. That must have been quite a show.
Well, all I did was ask him about the Bible.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think the first question I asked him was how he could promote the teaching of creationism in schools when the writers of the Book of Genesis thought the earth was flat.
Right.
You know, with rivers above and below us.
Yeah.
You know, the writers of the Book of Genesis knew nothing about the process of creation. That's not ultimately what they were writing about. They were writing about the purpose of creation, and that is something that they knew a lot about. And I think for those of us who, you know, are certainly raised, I mean, it remains probably the most important book in my own life. These people are not literalists. They're selective literalists. They pick out what is useful to their ideology, make up large parts of it, and ignore the rest. And I think that for those of us who come out of the biblical tradition or come out of the church, that's, you know, so telling as to what it is they're about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about what's in the Bible. It's about what they want to promote. And they talk about acculturating the society. In fact, what they've done is acculturated the Christian religion. And they've acculturated with, I think, the worst of American imperialism, American capitalism, and in that sense created an ideology that, for me, in many ways, bears no resemblance to the Christian faith at all. I mean, just the simple notion that Jesus all wants us to get rich, and that the poor are somehow poor because they're not right with God. I mean, I don't know how you can read the four Gospels and get that message. I mean, Jesus is obsessed with outcasts and the poor.
Right. The other thing that must be a hard sell is when you – this phrase caught my attention – when you're selling, you know, Christ as a warrior instead of Christ as the Prince of Peace, who seems to me as though that's the version. That's what's attractive to most people about him, this Prince of Peace.
Right.
Well, how do you sell the warrior?
Well, again, by pulling out those few passages that bolster the notion of Christ – as warrior. I mean, the book of Revelation.
Yes.
You know,
right.
And there are hateful passages in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There are very disturbing passages in the Bible. I mean, the Gospel of John is filled with very raw anti-Semitism. Paul, you know, not only attacks homosexuality, but defends the institution of slavery. You know, but these people talk about the Bible is literally true and we have to follow all the laws. Well, why aren't they all kosher?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why aren't they all following these bizarre lists of edicts in Leviticus? And I think that you can't have it both ways. Either you're a biblical literalist or you're not. And I don't know how you can be a biblical literalist since even the Gospels tend to contradict themselves. And you know, these were, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, passages were written to address particular historical circumstances at particular times, often 100 years apart. This thing of Christ the warrior, I think, is what you raise, is a really good example of how they have crammed, you know, the Christian religion and distorted it and misused it to essentially bolster what at its core is American imperialism and blind and intolerant and brutal American imperialism, because, of course, it's being sanctioned by Christ. That there is no religious or moral worth in their eyes to Islam, and therefore Muslims who are not converted should be wiped out.
Chris Hedges is our guest. His latest book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Thanks, Al, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris Hedges, our guest. His book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Before we go back to phone calls, I must ask you, Chris, because you've reported from war zones all over the world, and I greatly admire your earlier books on war. What do you think of what the president's going to say tonight? Is there any way that this kind of philosophy that you talk about in this book has found its way to the administration?
I think very much so, because when you believe you understand the will of God and can carry out the will of God, and there are certain indications that President Bush finds that a convenient belief system, you don't have to listen to anyone else.
Mm.
Not only that, reality sort of doesn't impinge on what's happening around you. So I think that there is, and, you know, the big question people have is President Bush a believer? I think, I don't know the man, but my guess is that he is. You know, he may pick and choose that parts of sort of, you know, that bolster his own sense of privilege and you know, his own aggrandizement. You know, he certainly fits the profile. Somebody who, you know, has shown no intellectual curiosity at all, who's lived, you know, up until certainly the age of 40 or early 40s, you know, a pretty pathetic existence, riding on his father's coattails, never sort of doing much, struggling with drug and alcohol problems. You know, he fits the profile. But I think this kind of belief system is one that, you know, once you embrace it, you no longer feel you have a necessity to listen to anyone, and perhaps even listen to your own conscience.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Susan next from Milwaukee. Hello, Susan.
Yes, hi. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
I have to say that I fundamentally agree with your guest philosophically. However, I have to say in all honesty that I think that your target audience is not listening to you because your rhetoric is a little too harsh. I think that this is the 21st century, and I think we need to get past the opposition, the you know, lobbing accusations at one another and try to get inside the person's head that feels this way and try through dialogue to transform their thinking. And I just don't think they're listening when you come across as you do. And that's just my comment, and I will take your reaction.
All right,
off
Susan.
Of there.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think you're right. I think they aren't listening. And I didn't really write the book in an effort to try and...
No, you didn't.
...to convert them or to convince them. I wrote a book for the rest of us to explain that this movement is not benign and that, you know, if we tolerate in an open society within our midst a movement that preaches and promotes intolerance, you know, we can enter a period of deep trouble. That's really why I wrote the book. I don't believe that there is a dialogue with people who deny my right to be. I think that all dialogue must begin with mutual respect and an understanding that both sides have a right to be.
Mm.
And I think that is a prerequisite for all dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, the notion that you can dialogue with people who ultimately call for your eradication unless you adopt their belief system is not a dialogue. You know, what is there to dialogue about? Either you adopt my belief system,
mm-hmm.
or you will be dispensed with. I don't know exactly what we're supposed to discuss.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Marshall from Stoughton. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. I have two comments. Good news first. I'm going to be teaching a physics course at UW-Madison this fall, Seeking Truth, Living with Doubt, on the relation between faith and reason. And this is actually one of five courses in that general area, which I regard as good news because it means that the universities are beginning to take this issue seriously. My other comment, and I'd like your reaction to both, please, is as a physicist, I find it unfortunate that it's the scientists who are remaining the quietest in this discussion because they have the biggest stick to carry, as Theodore Roosevelt said, on this issue. Could I take your get your comment on these matters?
I think, again, you know, your caller raises a really important point. I don't know why not only the scientists but the great universities remain silent on this issue, because this is an assault on ultimately on them, on their capacity to further scientific and academic work to keep alive intellectual inquiry, criticism, self-criticism, thought. That's what these and you see that when you look at the you know, what happens inside the walls of these so-called Christian universities. You know, these are anti-intellectual institutions, and I'm stunned at how passive and silent. But James Luther Adams, to go back to my ethics professor at Harvard, would not have been. This was something that deeply disturbed him.
He talked about what would happen to Harvard professors, right?
Yes, he said, you know, of course, I mean, it was sort of, you know, done a bit tongue-in-cheek, but
mm-hmm.
he told us that, you know, if the Nazis took over America, 60% of the Harvard faculty would begin their lectures with a Nazi salute. But let's remember that this was a man who attended lectures at the University of Heidelberg and watched Martin Heidegger begin his lectures with the Nazi salute.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks, Marshall, for the call. Steve from Houston, hi.
Yeah, good morning to you. I just have a couple points, if I may. I think some of the comments you've made are certainly true for a certain segment of Christianity, but I'm a unificationist. I've done tremendous interfaith work with Muslims, even radical Muslims and people of all faith. Throughout the country. I used to live in Wisconsin. I live in Texas now. And I found that many, many Christians, especially within the African-American community, people who, by the way, typically, according to polls, vote liberal Democrat and don't align themselves with any Christian, with it, Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell, who are people who love God and are deeply spiritual and deeply Christian, but nonetheless don't believe that waging war against Islam is the answer. And I think that I think most people fall within the mid-range. I think you're talking about a handful of people who don't have much influence anymore in America. Jerry Falwell is not regarded as a leader. I don't think Pat Robertson is. He keeps putting his foot in his mouth. And the people that are leading the way now are people that are talking about healing the hearts of many Americans who come from broken families, whose people are, lives are devastated. That's the force behind Christianity today.
All right. Would you agree, Chris?
I would. I think, you know, it's very hard to make blanket statements about even fundamentalists and evangelicals. I mean, these are very diverse groups. I mean, traditionally, there's been a lot of bad blood between fundamentalists and evangelicals. Fundamentalists oftentimes looking at, especially charismatics, as Satan worshipers because they speak in tongues. And fundamentalists traditionally withdrawing, you know, calling on their followers to withdraw themselves from the contaminants of secular society, not to engage in politics. I think that what we're seeing is really a new phenomena, more properly called dominionists. These are people who believe, they take that word from the book of Genesis, God gave man dominion over everything, etc. And what they've done is brought together these disparate factions in the drive to create a Christian nation, but all of these disputes remain. And you know, even among the same believers within the same church, you're going to find wide differences. So I think your caller, you know, raises an important point that it is very hard to make these generalizations. But I think the unifying the drive that has brought these people together and the sort of common goal that they have is creating the theocratic state. You know, when I would go to these events, I would see in the room Catholic priests, people dressed in Salvation Army, coming from the Salvation Army in uniforms, Pentecostals, charismatics, fundamentalists, you know, Baptists. I mean, this was unthinkable, you know, even a few decades ago, because these schisms were so deep and these animosities ran so deep. And I think that and that's what's new about this mass movement. Of course, all of these, you know, doctrinal and factional disputes remain, and should they ever achieve power, you know, there would be bloodletting among them, as there often is among revolutionary groups. Let me also just finally address the point that the actual hardcore is tiny. He's very right. The actual hardcore is minuscule. You know, it's hard to know, certainly less than 7%. It is tiny, but they control the levers of power, and they're very well funded. They control the Southern Baptist Convention. They control almost all the Christian radio and television networks. And of course, as we know from Crane Britton, who wrote in The Anatomy of Revolution, and others who've studied revolutionary movements, when you have a disciplined core, no matter how tiny, that is ruthless and that is well-funded and as sophisticated as these people are, who can count on the sympathy of 80 to 100 million American evangelicals, then, of course, you have an extremely dangerous situation. The America that they want to create is one I think most of their sympathizers would not want to live in. But, of course, they're very astute and very careful. And, again, that goes back to the corruption of language, to speak in terms that are familiar and comforting, to essentially mask a radical agenda that they want to implement in this country.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Tammy next from Wisconsin Rapids, running short on time. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, I'll keep it brief. Just two things. One, I'm actually quite distressed as someone who endorses some of the beliefs you're criticizing, though not all of them, the level of intolerance that you're showing. You know, as from a viewpoint that is supposed to endorse tolerance, it seems to me that using terms like fascism for some of the beliefs I hold is quite distressing and intolerant. And the second thing is there's an old quote about, you know, I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. And yet I hear your guests talking about taking away licenses from Christian radio stations. I guess these things distress me quite a bit in a democracy that I support. Thank you.
Thanks, Tammy.
I would not call for the blanket removal of licenses from Christian radio stations. I would call for the removal of licenses from Christian radio stations that call for the eradication of gay people, that preach that Islam is a satanic religion and Muslims have to be destroyed or converted. I think that the threat of being able to remove those licenses is incumbent upon a tolerant society that values and wants to promote tolerance. They are certainly free to have their stations. I think that in an open society, they are not free to call ultimately for extermination. And that, of course, is when you look closely at their belief in sort of end times and the rapture and Armageddon. They revel quite openly in this, and you know, going back to these movies and series, in the destruction of everybody who does not endorse them. And I think that within a democracy is unacceptable.
Chris, thank you so much. I've been looking forward to this hour, and you always live up to expectations. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Hedges, the book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. It has just been published by Free Press and is available in your local library or bookstore. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A reminder that the presidential address will be this evening. He'll be unveiling his new strategy for the war in Iraq, and the speech will be tonight at 8 o'clock. You can hear it right here. Copies of this hour, call the radio store, 800-747-7444. The program number is 110E, and this show repeats at 10 o'clock this evening. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.